The Sundance Film Festival is the most important showplace for independent films. The 25th festival wrapped up over the weekend in Park City, Utah. This was the 19th time that our critic at large John Powers attended. We asked him to tell us what he saw on and off screen. So, John, what were your overall impressions of Sundance this year?
Well, I think, Terry, that this was the most schizophrenic I've ever known Sundance to be. On the one hand, you have this kind of tiny film festival, you know, filled with films by first and second time filmmakers. And it's resolutely unglamorous in a lot of ways. I mean, you really haven't lived until you've gone to one of the theaters and gone to one of the porta-johns outdoors when it's 18 degrees. So there's that festival with young filmmakers. But what's built up around it over the last 20 years is this kind of festive atmosphere. And in a way, you might compare it to the Super Bowl, where you actually have the game, and then you have all the stuff that surrounds it. And Sundance is that way. So you have this small festival devoted to lack of commercialism and independent thinking. You have that. What surrounds it is this corporate fiesta. So the city of Park City is taken over by companies like Heineken and Chrysler and BlackBerry, who buy up the storefronts for the time during the festival and throw big parties and musical events and giveaways. And what that means is the city's then flooded with people who have no interest in the actual film festival, but who come in order to catch a glimpse of someone like Paris Hilton, who of course was there. I mean, like God, Paris Hilton seems to be everywhere. So Paris Hilton's there, Al Gore is there, Jennifer Aniston's there, and they're all pouring in for the media event of the festival, which is super commercial, super celebrity-driven, super unindependent. And you have those two things happening at once. They're inhabiting the same space. And this produces a very zoo-like atmosphere where you will be trying to get from one place to the next in order to see a first-time film that may never have any commercial future. And in fact, there's a huge traffic jam because there are people trying to get uptown in order to go to a party or see a glimpse of Jennifer Aniston.
So in this kind of like dual environment, did you spend time hiding in your hotel room or going to the movies?
Yes. Well, it used to be that when I was covering Sundance, I would actually do both. It's now almost impossible to do both. You either wind up covering parties, which is, I think, what a lot of the media does, because when you watch television, that's what they seem to be covering, or you go to the movies. I go to the movies. And it's an interesting and frustrating experience, because the thing that people need to know about Sundance is that it's not every film that's available that shows at Sundance. They're actually trying to find new talent, and they're trying to find talent that usually doesn't have a very big budget behind it. Some years there are still big movie stars. This was a year, it's the 25th anniversary of Sundance, and they were saying they went back to their roots. And what that means is that probably given a choice between a 50-50 call between a film with actors you've never heard of and actors you have heard of, they chose the smaller film. Because part of the strangeness of Sundance is that every year they get smacked for either being too commercial or not commercial enough. You know, if there are too many stars, people say Sundance is sold out. If there aren't enough stars, all the reports are what an incredibly dull festival it was.
John, tell us a little bit about the films at Sundance this year. Do you want to choose one or two that epitomize what's really special about Sundance and the kind of visibility it gives films that might otherwise never have been seen?
Yes. You know, there were a couple of films which were very much representative of what Sundance can do at its best. One was a very small film called Old Joy by Kelly Reichert, which I thought was the best film I saw in the entire festival. And it's a very simple story of two guys trying to rekindle an old friendship, you know, now that they've grown up a bit, trying to capture their youthful joys. And it's a very modest film in all of its externals. But it's Chekhovian because it is the story of these two guys who go off to a hot springs. And over the course of the movie, nothing seemingly happens, but by the end of the film, you're filled with melancholy and you understand completely the two people. It's very much like Chekhov. It's a wonderful film. At the opposite end, you said emotionally, you might have something like Wrist Cutters, a love story, which is based on an Israeli novella and is set in a world where everyone in it has already committed suicide. It's a kind of weird limbo. It's a black comedy, maybe in the Harold and Maude vein, where the hero kills himself and winds up in another reality where every single person there has killed themselves. And then they're trying to work out the meaning of life in this limbo that's kind of presided over by a godlike figure played by Tom Waits.
Okay. There's a movie called Little Miss Sunshine that all the press coverage has emphasized, all the press coverage of Sundance. And this is a movie that sounds like it's actually pretty commercial and very entertaining that ended up not having a distributor until Sundance. What did you think of the film?
Little Miss Sunshine is a very good film. It was one of those films that is shown on the opening weekend with the idea that distributors will pick it up. And so it was the hottest ticket of the entire festival. And, you know, people actually were bidding, I'm told, hundreds of dollars to get a ticket to the screening. The film itself is very much a commercial film of the kind that Hollywood would make. It has Greg Kinnear and Tony Collette and Steve Carell. And it's about a dysfunctional family. The thing that makes it different is that it's probably the funniest film I've ever seen at Sundance, or at least the funniest film I've seen since the movie Citizen Ruth, that was the first film by Alexander Payne. In addition to that, it's the first Sundance comedy I've seen in at least 10 years, maybe ever, that you thought could actually travel outside the rarefied confines of Sundance. You know, there's a general principle with Sundance films is that once they leave Park City, Utah, where the festival is, they tend to seem smaller. This was a film when you were watching it, you thought, oh, actually, audiences everywhere will like this movie. It's really funny. It has a whole range of jokes, from really good slapstick gags to jokes about Proust and Nietzsche, which isn't something you get in a normal Hollywood movie. It's a very, very good and funny film.
Several of the major studios now have independent film divisions within them. So why is that happening, and how is it affecting the style of independent films and even what we describe as an independent film?
Yes. Well, in the old days, an independent film was something that seemed to have two qualities. It had financial backing that came from not from a studio but from independent sources, and had an independent vision. What's happened over the years is that as Hollywood has kind of gotten caught in the blockbuster complex, that they've looked for other sources of filmmaking ideas. And one of those sources is the aesthetic ideas that you found initially at Sundance in movies like Sex, Lies, and Videotape. It turned out that such films could become profitable. And the industry, always looking to renew itself and buy up the latest thing, has now established a way in which every studio does have an independent division. And what they're doing is taking the kinds of themes and ideas that used to belong purely to independent film and integrating them into their own films. The examples of this year would be something like Brokeback Mountain. You know, it cost $14 million. It has an edgy subject, you know, put simply, you know, gay cowboys, and is done in a very simple style. You know, 15 years ago, this is the kind of film you might have seen at Sundance. I mean, it's better than that, perhaps, but it's the kind of film you might have seen then. But it's now a film from Focus Features, which is itself a branch of Universal. And Universal okayed the money and essentially paid for the film. And you find the same thing happening where every big studio has its branch, which brings out something. It will bring out its Capote. It will bring out its Good Night and Good Luck, which is a Warner Brothers film. And so what you've seen is that the studios have managed to acquire what used to be unique to independent film and make it part of its own.
One of the changes we've seen in the past few years in the film world is the popularity of documentaries at movie theaters. You know, they used to be played on television a lot, but it's only now that you're really seeing a lot of popular documentaries in movie theaters. And I think Sundance has played a role in popularizing the documentary and getting documentaries out there. So what was the documentary scene like at Sundance this year?
Well, I mean, Sundance has been crucially important for the development of documentaries, partly because they're so popular with the audiences in Park City. And I think people began realizing that if they're that popular with audiences there, they could be popular elsewhere. So every year, the documentary competition has grown more and more important. This year, I didn't see a lot of the documentaries. I saw some. And I mean, I just mentioned parenthetically there are 120 films that play there, so that you're constantly picking and choosing, trying to find the correct ones to go to. This year, I went to see three documentaries about Iraq, very, very different documentaries that weren't particularly strident. One of them was clearly an anti-war film, but the two best films, one called Iraq in Fragments, which won three awards at the festival, you know, showed us things about what's going on in Iraq that I'd never seen before. I've worked as a media columnist. I watch more television news than almost anybody I know. What was interesting about these documentaries was that it showed you things that you never, ever saw on American TV screens. The film Iraq and Fragments took you inside the life of a little boy in Baghdad who's a Sunni, whose family members and people who push him around believe that things were better under Saddam. It also took you inside a Shiite militia. And among the things you got to see, which I'd never seen before, were the Shiite militias going in and beating up people that they thought were guilty of selling alcohol. And then finally taking you up to the Kurdish area, where the Kurds were thanking the United States for making them free. And it showed you aspects of daily life and the way things looked in a way that I'd never seen before. It's very beautifully shot by this guy James Longley, well edited, and it actually was giving you a picture of things that you'd never before seen. And that's the things that documentaries at Sundance often do.
Well, the winners were announced over the weekend, and from what I hear, John, you didn't see any of the main winners at the film festival. So does that mean that we're talking to the wrong guy? Does this mean our relationship is over?
It does. Well, it's part of the shame of the thing that you haven't seen them. Yet you need to – people need to understand how this actually works, is that everyone is always picking and choosing from this huge menu of films. Five films are showing at once. So in the case of the dramatic competition winner, which is a film called Quinceañera, which I missed that film because I was off seeing the Iraq and Fragments documentary, which actually did win 3 awards. And so you're constantly being forced to choose. Some years you're lucky, some years you're not. I was on the jury at Sundance 1 year, and the dramatic film competition winner was a film called Sunday, which I think I can safely say was the film that had been seen by the fewest people ever of any winner. When we announced the winner, there was a gasp from the crowd because they hadn't seen the film. And afterwards, at the closing party, every journalist I knew came up and rebuked me because they were going to look bad with their editors because they hadn't seen the film that won. In fact, I was there for about 5.5 days. I saw 28 films, I think.
Well, apparently you didn't see enough.
Man, you don't see enough. And so you then seem as if you're not working. And meanwhile, what you are doing is because of the structure of the city is that you are taking buses in the freezing cold everywhere, standing outside for 30 minutes in the cold to get into a film. And then as soon as that's over, standing outside again because there's no place to eat there's no real place to eat in some of these screening areas. Okay, and waiting for another film and then doing that over and over again. So you're watching films for 10 or 12 or 14 hours and you can still miss the winners, which in fact, makes for enormous anxiety among journalists and lots of bitter laughter.
So John, the fact that you, someone who really knows Sundance, you've been there for 20 years, you were on the jury 1 year, your way around the festival, the fact that you missed some of the movies that won the big awards, what does that say about the actual meaning of the awards?
Well, the meaning of the awards at Sundance are a tricky thing, and they're tricky because more than most places, you're dealing with people who are unknowns. So you're not starting at Cannes, for instance, you will know that there's a film by Jim Jarmusch or Lars von Trier, and you'll know the contenders because of that. When you get to Sundance, many of the films by people who've never made films before, and a lot of those films will never have been shown, and no one will have any idea what the talent is like. So you're trying to guess which films sound good, or you're following your instinct, or you're thinking, oh, this plot sounds good, I'll go to see that particular film. So that's how you do it. Then by the time – the only people who probably see every film are a handful of journalists and the members of the jury, and they see all of them. And the juries at Sundance are famous for not always choosing the films that you think would win or for choosing films that don't prove to be the big movie that comes out of Sundance. Last year, the film that won was called 40 Shades of Blue, which had almost no commercial life in the U.S. But the movie that everybody talked about afterwards was The Squid and the Whale. So you actually don't really know for sure whether the award is the most important, in some cultural sense, movie to come out. And you don't know in advance whether it's going to be important. You don't know who made it. And so it's very hard to know your way around.
My guest is our critic at large, John Powers. We'll talk more about the Sundance Film Festival after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is our critic at large, John Powers. We're talking about the Sundance Film Festival, which wrapped up over the weekend. The success of Sundance has actually led this non-commercial, independent film festival to be this big commercial extravaganza. It's not that the films are commercial, but all the stuff surrounding it sounds like it's become very commercial. So do you think finally that's good or bad for the festival? It certainly gets it more press attention, but and more people showing up for it. But is that kind of commercialism likely to kill the actual spirit of Sundance or compromise it in some way? Can the both of them survive together side by side like that?
Well, I think to talk about whether or not it's good for the films, you have to go back to the old days of Sundance. I've been going to the festival since before it was Sundance. And back then, it was actually pretty dreary. The films were small. There weren't stars. And there was no corporate sponsorship to speak of. And when you went, you seemed as though you were just trapped in this small town watching movies aimed at the Lifetime Channel, if there'd been a Lifetime Channel then. Now, there are stars everywhere, and at some level that actually has helped the independent film world, and it made independent film so important that every studio has its film division. On the other hand, it's probably overshadowed the actual films at the festival. If you listen to the media coverage or read a lot of the media coverage in the Los Angeles Times, you'll find a lot of space being devoted to the gift bags being given to Paris Hilton or Jennifer Aniston. You will have coverage of the parties. When TV does it, they will go for the images that are exciting and that seem sexy and that sell. And those are very seldom the films. So you have this case where you have this huge gap between the fiesta and the festival. And I think it's not clear yet whether that's going to be bad in the long run for the festival or not.
So I know that you feel the parties were particularly commercial this year, that there's a lot of particularly commercial stuff. Nevertheless, I can't really let you go without asking you about the best party that you attended, if in fact you went to any.
Well, actually, probably the best party I attended was for a small film, which actually won an award called Stephanie Daly. What was nice about it was that it was less star-studded, you know, unless you consider Timothy Hutton a star, which I guess he no longer is. But he was there at the party. But it was a very nice, pleasant thing where I was talking to people, and even it grew kind of crazy. One of the things about these parties is that there's always a crush of people at the door waiting to get in. And you're kind of squeezed in as though it were some sort of feed tube. And as you go into the party, somebody else is blocked out. As soon as you leave, they push two more people in. So it's a very mad situation in that kind of way. You know, but I had a good time. Actually, the best times I had were seeing the good films and then talking to people about them. You know, I had some very nice conversations on the shuttle buses between things with people who either wanted to make it in the movie business or who just loved movies so much they came in from Park City for their annual vacation. You know, it's a kind of lovely thing to be someplace where people would actually fly in just to see the movies. And although there are thousands of people who don't, it's always wonderful when you meet people who love movies that much.
Well, John, thanks for talking with us about Sundance.
Okay, sure thing.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large and film critic for Vogue. The playwright Wendy Wasserstein died today of lymphoma. She was 55. She was known for her witty plays about women dealing with work, motherhood, feminism, and getting older. She won a Pulitzer Prize and a Tony for her play The Heidi Chronicles in 1989. Here's a moment from our 1987 interview.
I think a theme that runs through several of your plays is women trying to figure out what kind of lives they want to live, uh-huh. What kind of adults they want to be. Was that difficult for you to figure out when you got out of college? Did you flounder around for a while trying to figure out what you wanted to do with your life?
It still is. I don't think it's over. I wish I could tell you yes, and I figured it out, and I'm marvelously happy. I mean, I think that it's something that goes on for a long time. My elder sister is 50 and is quite an interesting woman, and she's still, you know, grappling with these things. My mother still is. I think that there are a lot of choices and there are a lot of definitions, and especially with women, we're given a different definition every 4 years. So 4 years ago, we were told to have it all, and now we're told to be, I think we're beginning to be told to become wonderful mothers again. I get that sense. So I think, yes, I'm someone who's still grappling with that.
Wendy Wasserstein recorded in 1987. 12 years later, at the age of 48, she gave birth to her daughter, Lucy. Wasserstein died today of lymphoma. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.